This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy. Six shows into its first season on the air, the NBC show The West Wing took on a subject that it's probably safe to say had never been treated on primetime television before.
Sam, I read my briefing book last night on the Commerce Bill regarding the census, and there's certain parts of it that I don't quite understand.
I can help you out. Which parts?
Well, all of it.
All of it?
Yes.
That's CJ, the presidential press secretary character, who finally admits to her deputy, Sam, that she's been faking her way through all of the press briefings on the census bill.
I've been playing it fast and loose, there's no doubt about it, but sitting in on some of the meetings we've been having and reading the briefing book last night, I have to say that the census is starting to sound to me like it's, well, important.
Important or not, the actor playing CJ, her name is Allison Janney, later told the PBS NewsHour that she was stunned to learn that producer Aaron Sorkin had written a show about the census.
I thought Aaron was crazy. I read that and I was like, well, this is going to be the most boring thing ever.
Which, in essence, was our reaction when our producer suggested we devote an entire show to the census. And we're academic historians with a high boredom threshold. But then we got to talking about it, and it quickly became clear to us, as it did to Allison Janney before us, how much of what's important in American history comes back to, you guessed it, the census.
Now I can guarantee you everyone who saw that show is going to fill out their census.
If you were among the 74% of Americans who did fill out and mail back their form last year, you know that it was a relatively straightforward process. 10 questions, many of which have been there since the very first census back in 1790. But over the years, the form has changed in significant ways. Today on the show, we're going to explore how those changes on the decennial census form reflect profound shifts in our understandings of what it has meant to be an American. We'll start at the very beginning of the story.
Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers.
This, of course, is the section of the U.S. Constitution that established the House of Representatives. And though it may sound ho-hum to you now, the idea of basing a system of government on an actual nose count was utterly groundbreaking back in 1787.
Unfortunately, the common association with the census was all negative.
That's Michael Quinn, the director of Montpelier, James Madison's historic home here in Central Virginia. James Madison, you will remember, was our fourth president, but he was also the main author of the Constitution.
Why would government want to count people? Well, usually there are two reasons. They either want to take more of their wealth, so they want to find out who you are and where you live, or else they want to draft people for an army, which means they're going to conscript your young men.
In 1787, conscripting young men wasn't really at the top of the founders' to-do list, but taking people's wealth, well, it's fair to say it was. They were keenly aware that if the young nation was going to survive, the central government would need to figure out a way to fund itself. The genius of Article I was that by tying both taxation and representation to that nose count, it assured that citizens wouldn't try to shirk their fiscal responsibilities by laying low when the nose counter came around. They had an incentive to stand up and be counted.
And that is classic Madisonian thinking. You know, Madison again and again said you should never trust anyone. Now, at the same time, he never gave up. What he realized the need for was to have counterbalancing forces, motivations.
Well, if you think that's good, it gets better. Because not only did the founders create a legislative body that would truly reflect the shape of its constituency, they also made sure that it would continue to do so on into the future.
The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years, in such manner as they shall by law direct.
They recognized how quickly the country was growing and how rapidly it was changing. They anticipated people moving west. So they talked about the fact that if we set forever, once and for all, how we are represented in Congress here at this Constitutional Convention, that will be an unjust distribution of power in 10, 20, 30 years. So they came to the conclusion that if we count people, then we will always, we're literally building in a revolution every 10 years in the American system, because we will reapportion the number of representatives in Congress. And it ended up stripping power over time from very powerful states at the beginning, and it did it in a very peaceful manner.
That's Michael Quinn, director of James Madison's Montpelier.
Peter, like just about everything in your period, it could have gone quite differently, right? Because a lot of people said that people should, in essence, be counted based on their wealth. Am I wrong?
Yeah. This notion of wealth being represented was a traditional idea in early modern societies. It's the stake in society idea that those who own should be the ones who control the distribution of their own property.
Who eat steak.
Yeah, yeah. But in the revolutionary period, a new idea was in the air, and that was the idea of popular sovereignty. When you had this fiction, as it's called, this idea that the people are the source of legitimate authority, well, who's the people? Everybody's the people.
You know what I don't understand, though, Peter, is we know that very few people really voted. Most people were not allowed to vote. Because they didn't own property, or they were women, or they were owned by somebody.
Hold it. So
why do we need why do we need to count everybody?
Oh, come on, people include women? Not in this period.
But we counted them for the census. That's my question.
Well, that's true. And this is the radical revolutionary move, as Mike Quinn suggests, and that is there's a whole new idea of the source of legitimate authority comes from the people. And the people is not simply the big property owners or the property owners, because those numbers and proportions vary. And, of course, everybody, except for slaves and Indians not counted, they're citizens. And so they have to be represented. You know, we have this idea that representation is direct and that everybody has a say and a vote in who is going to represent them. Well, there is another theory of representation. You might call it a virtual representation in which the patriarch of the family, the householder, is representing everybody in his family. So women are represented, Brian. That is, they have the status of citizens, and even though they can't vote and have very little civil competence, they can't do very much, but nonetheless, they are represented. So,
but Peter, why do we care how many of them there are?
Well, the real reason for this, Brian, is to achieve an enduring balance in the federal union.
So it's competition between the elites.
Well, yeah. Well, there's no question about it. And it's the tension between this elite concern with having an effective voice in the councils of the national government, the new federal government, combined with this new revolutionary theory that the people are represented. That's the master fiction of the age. So these elites, to justify themselves, have to claim that they're not representing themselves. They're representing larger populations. And meanwhile, you can't assess the relative voting strength of a state according to wealth or property, because there are so many different kinds of property.
And, of course, there's a weird wrinkle in all of this. Mm-hmm. The category that is both human and property, and, of course, we're talking about enslaved people.
No, absolutely.
They have, you know, you talk about fictions, Peter. Now, one fiction is that an enslaved person, male or female, young or old, counts as three-fifths of a free person, right? Yeah. So you have this kind of thing that it has the census, and it's adding it up and counting it, and it's based on human population. Yeah. But by the very nature of doing that, it's converting it into a political fiction, which is also an economic fiction.
Yeah, and, no, you're right on.
So Michael Quinn was talking about how the founders were visionary and you know, building in the population as the real basis of representation, so that they knew that the states of the West are going to come into being and the states of the East. But, you know, what were they thinking about the three-fifths clause? Did they see this as an enduring foundation for the Constitution, or did they expect this to kind of fade away with time?
No, I mean, they certainly thought that everybody went into this thing with their eyes open and understood what they were compromising. But we can see the three-fifths clause as a time bomb that was going to go off, because once you've recognized the idea that slaves are human, and then you compromise that idea and say they're somewhat less than human, Then that powerful idea of equality, which is all over the place in the Revolution, the Declaration, but also in the Constitution, in the census is predicated on the idea of equality. That is, equal numbers of voters in different states are going to be represented equally in the House of Representatives. I mean, that's very important.
So, Peter, that's very interesting that we have this sort of language of equality all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, ironically, there's been one continuity in the census. Across all three of our centuries, they focused on racial distinction, and not just any racial distinction, but that between white and black, or what they called in the early 19th century, white and colored. And as the census becomes more sophisticated, more granular, they devise more granular language for race as well. So in 1850, they come up with a new category, a third category, mulatto, to describe someone of indeterminate proportion of black and white. Now, we're going to hear about this from Melissa Nobles, who's a political scientist at MIT, who's written about this shift in terminology. She says the new category was mostly the doing of an Alabama doctor named Josiah Knott, who believed that racial mixing was unhealthy. So for years, he had been publishing articles and lobbying senators to start keeping track of this dangerous mulatto population.
I hope I have said enough to make apparent the paramount importance of Negro statistics. If the blacks are intellectually inferior to the whites, if the whites are deteriorated by amalgamation with the blacks, if the longevity and physical perfection of the mixed race is below that of either of the pure races, and if the Negro is by nature unfit for self-government, these are grave matters for consideration. Josiah Knott, DeBow's Review, 1847.
He had a long-standing interest in, not in slavery, because he believed that slavery required no defense, and he also believed blacks inferior, and that required no defense. But what he was interested in is the idea of polygenesis, meaning that blacks and whites were different species. And so he thought that the mulatto was really the key to understanding the nature of human differences and human variation. His theory was that mulattoes would be an example of the deleterious effects of racial intermixture, and he wanted more statistical data to prove that. And so
the crucial question there was, were mulattoes doomed to have a shorter life?
Exactly.
Right?
So
that,
you would want
that was what you
that's
could
exactly
measure,
right. And so you would want the mulatto category on censuses over time, right? Because you would want to have a longitudinal study, right? You want to see over time were these people in fact dying off. And that is why he lobbies a senator from Kentucky, Joseph Underwood, to get mulatto category on the 1850 census, and he succeeds.
That's Melissa Nobles, author of Shades of Citizenship, Race and the Census in Modern Politics.
When the recent batch of census numbers was released, most of the news coverage focused in on the actual data. But today, we're going beyond the numbers and looking at the census process itself. For the past few weeks, we've been inviting your questions and comments on our website, and our producers have invited a few of you who weighed in there to join us on the phone.
First up today, we have Rebecca calling in from across the northern border in London, Ontario. Rebecca, welcome to Backstory.
Oh, it's so nice to be here.
We're talking about our census, so why are you calling?
Actually, I'm kind of curious about how Native Americans figured in the census, and from a Canadian point of view,
yeah.
I'm kind of curious about the Great Plains and the prairies and everything, because I know people were moving around a great deal in the 19th century still,
right.
So I'm kind of curious about how people who are moving around are kind of in national space but aren't really of it.
Wow.
And who can cross that really porous 49th parallel quite easily. Like, how exactly would they figure in the census, and would they be counted, or were they just kind of a big blank?
Well, as you can might imagine, it changes over time, which is the only reason we have a show. But if I'm not mistaken, the first time that the American Indians were really included in the census in any really meaningful way was 1870,
mm-hmm.
which you will have noticed
is centuries after the first contact. In some ways, it went hand in hand with a greater attention to all kinds of ethnicities. And so there had been, as we've heard from Melissa Nobles, an annotation of mulatto all the way back to 1850. After emancipation, they began to add in other ethnicities, such as Chinese and Japanese. But by the time you get to 1890, it seems incumbent upon the census to slice and dice African-American identity into ever smaller pieces, all the way down to octoroon, one-eighth blood. So as we see, over the course of the late 19th century, the Census Bureau uses its expertise, its greater reach into the American population, to draw ever finer gradations across the American population. And American Indians are a part of that.
Yeah, Rebecca, I loved your expression, national space. And I wonder if you'd like to tell us a little bit about your own perspective on this, that is, how to pin people down, in effect, and to count them. And in the early censuses, of course, they weren't counted because they were not part of the constitutional population for purposes of representation. They were instead outside the bounds, yet somehow they were also within this national space.
Well, that's what I just find so interesting about it. So it's like the nation is kind of arriving around them while they've got an entirely different culture and economy and way of organizing themselves that sort of encroaches on this dynamic space right in the middle of the country.
So Ed, what about 1870? What was going on in Indian country?
Well, let me ask you a question. What happened in 1869?
Ooh, one of those big battles?
No, the Transcontinental Railroad.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is obviously after the Civil War. You've got the Union Army out there, as they see it, pacifying the American Indians. So it's interesting that the American Indians finally gain a presence only at the time that the American government really feels it has command over them.
Yeah, Rebecca, it's a great question.
Well, thank you so much for answering my question.
Thank you
for calling.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye.
So in the case of Indians in the second half of the 19th century, these statistical categories really become a means for government control. Was that also the case on into your century, Brian?
Yeah, I would say even more so. Certainly by the 1920s, with the rise of the eugenics movement, a movement that believed that people's destiny was determined by their ancestors' genetic material, people are looking to control more and more. So data that you guys have been talking about, race, that had always been part of the census, now got operationalized, if you will, a 20th century term, if there ever was one.
Right, right.
That meant right here in Virginia, for instance, people couldn't marry other people based on what race they were, and we tried to enforce those racial divisions more and more strictly.
And you know, you talked about operationalizing, which really is a truly ugly 20th century word.
It is. I take such pride in it.
Yeah. What would you say in the 19th century, Ed?
Making manifest.
That's very good.
Yeah.
That's good.
So speaking of operationalizing, Brian, or making manifest, the danger comes when the numbers are turned into individual people. So let me tell you something that happened right here in Virginia, in Richmond, in the capital, back in the 1920s. A man named Walter Plecker, the head of the Bureau of Vital Statistics, decides to use the power of that office to really interrogate the racial identity of people who are applying to him for marriage certificates and birth certificates. He would write to new mothers and say, "I see you've registered your child as white, but our records here show clearly that his father is black. You better not have this young boy going to school with whites, marrying whites, because the state is watching," right? And so, you know, as insidious as the Three-Fifths Clause was and as the abuse of aggregate statistics was, it was this sort of lowering of the boundary of the state to really penetrate into the most intimate aspects of people's lives that I think even the people who believed in so-called racial purity in the South recognized how dangerous this was. And Plecker really was forced to retract.
We've emphasized the negative aspect of all of this racial classification, but by the end of my century, people are actually asking, demanding to be classified. And that's because increasingly, there's legislation that requires racial classification. I mean, the most important of those pieces of legislation is the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And it's based on the underrepresentation of African Americans, primarily in the South. And how do you invoke the Voting Rights Act? Well, you need to show that a certain percentage of African Americans are not being registered at the polls. And this data provided by the census is crucial to one of the great mobilizations in all of American history. That is African Americans beginning to vote in the Deep South, which they had not been allowed to do for almost 75 years. So I have a little test for you guys.
All right.
Where in the larger American empire in the 20th century was race not used in the census?
Hawaii?
That's larger American empire.
Yeah, that's kind of a hint.
Wow. Okay, what else do we have now? We don't have the Philippines anymore, barely. How about Puerto Rico?
You got it. Puerto Rico, after 1950, dropped the question of race, and it didn't start asking about it again until 2000. I asked Fernando Armstrong, the Puerto Rico area manager for the 1980 census, what explained this strange omission.
The concept of race in Puerto Rico has never been as prevalent as it is in the States. If we go back to the history of the island, the Puerto Rican population is a very, how would I say, complex mix of the European, the African population that came as slaves, and the local Indian population that lived in the Caribbean. So the concept of white, black, Asian is not very meaningful concept in the island of Puerto Rico.
So, Peter, Ed, Puerto Rico, the first post-racialist society in America?
Yeah, I think that that's a fair way to think about it. But you could also think back to before.
I was hoping you would think back,
well,
Peter.
Yeah, well, that's what I tend to do. I'm a backward thinker. To, of course, the pre-American period in the Caribbean and the Spanish Caribbean. And our categories are utterly alien to those of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and other islands where you have really mixed societies.
Yes, so that's an interesting point, Peter. The racial complexity of the Caribbean is suddenly radically simplified when Puerto Rican people come to the mainland in the 20th century. And they live here for a while, and the federal government looks around and says, you know, I see a new ethnic identity here, which is that all you people are speaking Spanish, and we're going to call that Hispanic. And so suddenly in the 1980 census, you have a whole new category that's not racial in the way that they would have thought of things in the 18th or the 19th century, but rather is a kind of a racialized concept of a language that someone speaks.
And you know what, Ed? The remarkable thing is that Mexican Americans whose families have been living here for hundreds of years all of a sudden find that they're part of that new category. And you know what else? The three of us are part of a new category. We are non-Hispanics.
Oh,
and
even though
I won the Spanish award at Ponce de Leon Junior High School in Coral Gables, Florida, I am a non-Hispanic all of a sudden. But guys, in all this discussion about identity, it's very easy to forget the fundamental purpose of the census, which is to apportion the United States and determine representation. And that's where Puerto Rico is actually really pretty interesting again. Because as members of a U.S. protectorate, the citizens of Puerto Rico don't get representatives in Congress. Right. So if, in fact, as you pointed out very early on in the show, Peter, that one of the incentives for folks for filling out the census or responding to the enumerators was to get counted and get voted, why would anybody bother to send back their form or talk to an enumerator in Puerto Rico? I put that very question to Fernando Armstrong.
You are correct. In Puerto Rico, there is a resident commissioner in Congress, only one, and there's no apportionment of the House, any change as a result of the census.
Right.
However, at the local level, at the state level, the Puerto Rico legislature is apportioned, the redistricted, based on census figures.
I see.
And at the municipal level and city level, all those local districts are changed based on census figures.
Yeah, Mr. Armstrong, you make such a great point, because we think about the census as, well, it's written into the Constitution. It's a very national, federal program. Yet the data, even in Puerto Rico and in states and localities on the mainland in the United States, they use these data for all kinds of very important local and state redistricting decisions.
Right, right. And on top of that, Brian, the every year, more than $400 billion are distributed in many different ways using formulas that use census figures. So it's political representation, and it's also economic power that the localities receive with a good and accurate census.
That's Fernando Armstrong. He spoke to me on the phone from Philadelphia, where he now serves as the director of the Census Bureau's regional office.
So there's a lot of money at stake. That's something that's new in the 20th century. Certainly back in the 19th century, everybody knew there were undercounts, but it didn't really have the meaning that it did in your century, Brian. How does that unfold?
Well, it unfolds, first of all, because there are now so many federal programs that are tied to the income of citizens in the various states.
So they actually want to count more people of poverty.
That's right. It's good to be poor.
Right.
For some,
sort of turning the stake in society upside down, huh?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So starting in the 1980s, cities began to sue the federal government for the consistent underrepresentation of minorities in the census. And I actually, you guys won't believe this, but I actually participated in a lawsuit that New York City filed in the 1980s against the federal government. Why? Because I ran some welfare programs. And how were we going to prove that there was an undercount? Well, we used my welfare rolls to identify people who showed up on welfare but did not show up in the raw data for the census, thus proving this undercount. Why did we want this? We wanted this for programs like the school lunch program, which are funded based on the amount of impoverished people in a district. Well, 30 years later, I got to talk to the guy I was suing, or we were suing, suing for incompetence, in fact. His name is Vincent Baraba, and in 1980, he was the Census Bureau director.
At one of my lighter moments, I said, you know, the ultimate slap in the face is being sued for incompetence by the city of New York. And Mayor Koch, from then on, he called me Barabbas, the robber.
The Census Bureau ultimately prevailed in that lawsuit. And to be fair, we should say that most of what we know about the undercount over the years comes from none other than the Census Bureau itself.
I think the Census Bureau is the only agency of government that not only willingly admits it makes a mistake, but quite precisely estimates
right.
the extent to which it made that mistake. And it doesn't do it to beat itself up. It does it because it wants to learn how to do a better job the next time out.
Now, census directors are political appointees, and because of voting patterns, not all of our leaders in Washington have the same interest in counting every last urban resident. But since Vincent Baraba has the notable distinction of being the only census director ever to have served presidents in both political parties, we can assume he's more or less of a straight shooter. And so I was particularly interested to hear his take on the challenges the Census Bureau faced in 1980 when it fanned out across America's cities.
It was relatively straightforward and easy to get to each household. But whether you got everybody inside the household enumerated was right. always a more complex question, because there might have been some people living in that household who were there, you know, maybe there were more people living in the household than were allowed, or that somebody right. might be living there in an undocumented status.
Right.
But then the other part was is that there was a lot of movement, you know, in our society at that time. We had just gone through the age of Aquarius and things of that nature, and people were a lot looser with their living conditions. Mm-hmm. And so
is it fair to say that relationships were not as clearly bounded or clearly defined?
Oh, there's the classic. I mean, we used to have a thing called the head of the household. Okay. You didn't want to know who the head was. They just wanted to have somebody that you could relate everybody else in the household to. And when we first sent out the test questionnaire, I mean, from Texas, we used to get, we take out a negative response saying, what do you mean the head of our household? We don't have a head in our household. So that's when we came up with, put a person in column one.
That's Vincent Barraba. He served as U.S. Census Bureau Director from 1973 to 1976, and again from 1979 to 1981. You can hear a full version of our conversation and all the other interviews in the show at backstoryradio.org.
In 80 million mailboxes across the USA, the census is a-coming to help us plan the way.
It's time for a break. When we get back, we'll hear from a census enumerator who is paddling the pavement from door to door when Vincent Barraba was barely out of his diapers.
You can count on me.
Can we count on you?
You can count on me.
Help your community get equal government representation. Help show where funds are needed for jobs, schools, health care, and more. Answer the 1980 census.
And all your answers are kept confidential.